You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So as I said, today is, I think, a very special lunch for any number of reasons. One, we have Nancy, we're privileged to have Nancy Hafkin here, who is has been working on issues of technology, gender, and development for a while. Let's just say she was, I think, about first in our era and has done amazing work in Africa and continued onward, authoring books, doing thought work, but also doing action work within the UN system and beyond, and has just been a fabulous contributor with her wisdom and actions over so much time. So it's great to have her back at the Berkman Center. We're also thrilled to have Dorothea here, who has done some pretty remarkable things in this book. I think, as someone who has long worked at the intersection of information and communication technology and development, she has thoughtfully, honestly, and availably answered some of the questions that we all get. Like, what, do you want everyone to have computers? My email is a nightmare. This is terrible. What are you trying to foist on people? What is development anyway? How should we think about the digital divide? What is this digital divide? So she's taken these questions that you get from everywhere, from cocktail party banter, from someone who knows nothing about this space, to the most sophisticated scholars in this space, asking these very hard questions about how do we reflect, how do we think about information and communication technologies as they intersect with development, and what do we mean by development. And therein, she's, as noted in the program, done really, I think, important work to take Amartya Sen's ideas about development as freedom and the capabilities approach and actually ground them in something that we can use as scholars in a way that makes them applicable and allows us to kind of dive into them more deeply. I think there are some really significant contributions, even the much more remarkable that she did some of this work in the context of her dissertation and then presented a book that you would not recognize in a bad way as a dissertation-driven book. So I really recommend it highly. I think it is informative, accessible, and a really valuable contribution. And I'm not just saying that. And then finally, I would note, as a former resident and big fan of Chile, she does the work in Chile, which is also great, in a town called Algún, as it happens. So with that, please, Dorothea, take us away.
Okay, I will. Do you come in? We've still got some seats. Fantastic. Okay, so thank you, everyone, for coming on a day like this with those temperatures and that weather outside. I really do appreciate you kind of coming into a confined space with the shutters down. Also, it's a great privilege to have Nancy here as discussant. It's fantastic that Colin had a chance to kind of introduce, and generally the great team at Berkman helping us set this up. Slightly daunting to also have my commissioning editor in the room, Margie Averi, there, but I make this as a plug. Basically, this working with MIT has been a true privilege, and if you want to pitch a book, this is a good time to do it. So over there is Margie to kind of have a chat about your book ideas. I'm also very happy to be here at Berkman to present this, because without Berkman, I'm not entirely sure this book would have ever gotten finished. In 2011, I had a period of research leave, and I stayed here. Tom was there as well as a Berkman fellow, and I had a wonderful time here interacting with people. And there were people here who believed that writing a book was a good way to spend time. And this is incredibly motivating when you're trying to get something done. So this book also owes a great deal to Berkman itself, and you'll enjoy reading the acknowledgments, I think. Anyways, right now my role is I'm the director of the ICT4D Centre at the University of London, Royal Holloway. There we basically engage in research and in teaching in this area of information and communication technologies for development. I put out a few flyers there for some of the master's work that we do. There's URLs on the slide presentation. The one at the top here gives you more information on the kinds of things that we do. We're 10 faculty, and then cross disciplines, and then PhD students and masters who work in this area. But now to the book. So I'll obviously only have a limited amount of time. I'll try to keep it under half an hour to just give you some key ideas of what the book is about. So I'm starting on very familiar ground when I say that technology is not neutral. This is something that at Berkman resonates very well. So whether it's Castells reminding us that society and technology are very deeply interlinked, or whether it's Lawrence Lessig basically telling us how norms and values are written into code, or indeed feminists like Judith Weissmann reminding us that the actual institutions that mediate access to the internet are themselves inscribed, and they have carry specific norms and expectations, which often are gendered. All of these things remind us that when we talk about technology, we're talking about a space of values. And this is central to the understanding of the book. Talking about values, development is an exceedingly normative concept. So we have to, when we use that word, development, we need to define what we mean by development. And one of the things I'd like you to think about for a moment is to just think about it. You don't have to say it out loud. Think about something that you yourself value, you care about. Okay, just that moment. So I bet you many of people in this room will have thought of things other than a pile of money. And that's because while many of us, if we think about a house or, you know, wanting to live close to all our family and friends or wanting to do loads of travel or whatever, while our dreams might be very multifaceted and we understand that you might need financial resources to make them true, you don't actually need, you don't actually have this vision of financial resources being the be-all and end-all of your life. At least not many people have that idea. And so in our everyday lives, it's perfectly clear to us that economic resources here, you know, are just the means to get to all these different things that we might value. And yet in development, we have this immensely strong drive to equate economic growth and development, as though this was actually an end rather than a means to something else. And so what the book calls for, and many scholars are calling for, is to actually shift this kind of orthodoxy of econocentricity to a much more holistic way of thinking about development. And in terms of our understanding, we need to move from a more linear to a more systemic approach. And we also want to move, because of these differences in what we value, we need to move away from a top-down approach, which is supply-led, to a much more dialogue approach, which is choice-led. And choice will be a central theme in what I'll say next. And a key leader in this area has obviously been Amartya Sen, presenting what is probably the best known alternative to an econocentric view of development. And that's his capabilities approach. And, you know, I could very easily cover not just, you know, a half an hour seminar, but like a seminar for a couple of weeks just on the capabilities approach. But what you need to know for this talk is that Sen says that development can be seen as a process of expanding the real freedom that people enjoy, focusing on the substantive freedom of people to lead the lives they have reason to value and enhance the real choices they have. And if you think, like, what, in 98 for that idea, you got the Nobel Prize in Economics? No, it's actually a body of work that goes back decades, and it's much more complicated than that, but this is the essence. So we're talking about expanding the freedom that people have to live the lives they themselves have reason to value. That's a radical shift in terms of our understanding of development. Capabilities, and there's a whole host of other terms that come up there, are basically words that kind of describe the different concepts in Sen's work. Capabilities are things that people have reason to value doing or being. But the key, I would suggest for this talk, the key thing that you need to remember is that development according to Zen, is about that people, the lives that people themselves value. Now, Zen has had some criticism for his approach, and one of the key critiques have been that this is all very nice in conceptual terms, in philosophical terms, but if you are in the field and you're actually trying to implement a project or a development program, operationalizing this is going to be very, very difficult. And so there's also a field of scholars who are working on operationalizing this. So from 97 onwards, scholars in communications have been thinking about, okay, how to translate and operationalize the capabilities approach for the field of communications and specifically for the field of ICT4D. And at the bottom, I also plugged there two PhD students working with me, so just to kind of give you a sense that this is ongoing work and it is being expanded. So my own contribution in this space has been the choice framework, and this is basically an attempt to map a systemic development process. I'll talk you through this. So we have four elements, basically. So we have agency, which is based on 11 different kinds of resources. And these 11 different resources that an individual may have, only two of them are the classic financial resources and material resources. There's other things like educational resources, psychological resources, information, cultural resources, time, social resources, natural resources, geographical resources, and health. And immediately it might occur to you that income-poor people might have resources here which aren't necessarily covered in financial and material resources. So they can be rich in other resources. So that's an important thing to understand about this concept of agency. Then there's structures, and you know, if you look at institutions, discourses, policies, formal and informal laws, and indeed technologies and innovations, this is the space, the social space, that the individual with their resources needs to navigate. And in the book, then, it kind of goes into a little spiel also on structuration theory and how the two are linked and so on. But I'll save you that for now. But the point is the individual operates in these structures and then achieves particular degrees of choice in terms of what choices are open to them, what choices they understand that they have, they sense they have, what they use, and then whether or not they're successful in achieving what they set out to do. And development outcomes then are, in the first place, with Zen, an extension of choice, but then also all the things that a person might choose as the things that they value. Okay, so this side is not pre-selected. That is something that depends on the individual. I'll give you another example on how to apply this. If, for example, in the capabilities approach, a typical example is the bike. It's the bicycle. So take a development project which is based around donating bicycles to people. Okay. So let's say someone my age, my gender, woman in her 30s, is given a bicycle. This extends basically her material resources. If she's in good health, she might be able to use it. Her informal training might mean that she knows how to ride a bicycle. And she's got the information where she needs to go. She's then using that bicycle in a context of institutions. So issues like there's actually an infrastructure of roads that you can use, that there's a road code that is already in place. And importantly, the social norms locally allow a woman in her 30s to actually ride a bicycle, which is not a given in all societies. So if this is a possibility, she might be then using that bicycle. She has the extended choice. She knows about it. She uses it and achieves this choice and might, for example, achieve increased mobility through this bicycle. Okay? And, of course, the increased mobility then might mean that she can gather information in a town that she can now reach, which then informs her agency area and that it basically bumps up her information or her social resources in her portfolio. So you can get an idea about how an intervention might be mapped in this system. So one is systemic mapping of development processes. And the other thing is we might actually go as far as trying to use this to design for improved choice. So we might actually be saying, okay, this is how we might make a change in the structural conditions, or we might improve a particular resource in order to improve the outcomes for this individual in terms of increasing their choice. So the book then applies this to Chile, and in particularly the ICT policies available in Chile. Little bit of intro to Chile. Of course, you know all of this. Chile stretches on the west side of South America, 4,000 kilometers in length. And as you can see from this e-readiness map from the ITU, in the early 2000s to mid-2000s in particular, Chile had this kind of outstanding position in being an ICT leader in the region. And that was partly due to their intense investment in IT infrastructure, with an internet backbone running the full length of the country. Chile enjoyed a decade and more of continued economic growth, low levels of corruption, high literacy, over 95%. So in many ways, this was an area which was very promising for ICT-assisted development. At the same time, there was a high level of social inequality and regional inequality, which meant that we would probably expect digital divides to play a role. Chile's Agenda Digital, then, was a pioneering set of policies which was cross-departmental and which was aimed at basically providing a comprehensive framework, policy framework, for ICT-assisted development in the country. And I only focused on three aspects of the Agenda Digital. One was the network of info centers, so free telecenters. One was e-government, and particularly the online procurement program, and free IT literacy training, particularly the one for out-of-school adults. To give you a little bit of a flavor of Chile, this is the context in which the policymakers live. So you have a downtown, Santiago de Chile. You have Wi-Fi in the underground, which certainly beats London and probably the T, but this is very clean and very fast and nice Wi-Fi as well. This is the everyday reality of sort of a professional middle class in Santiago, laptops strapped to their backs, walking down the street, and a discourse of social mobility through learning English and indeed through learning ICT skills. This then is the context in which the policymakers operate and work. So in this tower, the Chile Compra people, basically the online procurement system, has been devised, and it's still run from there. So here gives you a little bit of the interface there. It's a reverse auction system, which basically meant that from mid-2005 onwards, all goods and services that the state shopped that were above $179 were basically run online through this reverse auction system. And that meant that anyone wanting to sell to the state needed to go through this system. This was the vision of the deputy director of Chile Compra when talking about the position of Chile Compra in Chile's development. The important thing is that people are proactive and are interested in doing better than others. We have to create the conditions and the tools in which they can do that. This all has to do with the economic model in which Chile is developing itself. Yes, in the end, this is a neoliberal market economy in which the lances all point in one direction, so that the most efficient will win. So he had a very clear idea in terms of what development was and what role Chile Compra could play. And he was concerned about people who weren't involved in that vision. I believe that essentially one has to invest much in education in the regions as well, especially the rural sphere, how to include it in the wagon of productivity, in the engine of development. But at the same time, this is difficult because there are also obviously the values of those communities values that can be from another planet, even other spiritual beliefs. So obviously there's also reference here to indigenous cosmovisions that might be quite different from mainstream Chilean society. So here, what is being presented is sort of this one-track model of development. So there's kind of this wagon of productivity, and everyone has to get on board, and there's a single track. This is very different from the radical pluralism that Zen talks about. When Zen basically talks about the lives that people might value, it's a very open-ended approach. So this is, if you want, the other planet that he was talking about, values that can be from another planet. This is the other planet. So the other part of the fieldwork then switched from the world of the policymakers to the world of these rural communities. And this is a particular rural community which I call Algun. In the research, the name has been changed. And it's a 13,000 inhabitant community in one of the poorest areas of Chile. It basically tests out how all of these policies that were made in the center actually play out in the periphery. You can see the two phone masts there, and you can see those are privately owned. And you can see how the public infrastructure, say, for example, the roads, are not particularly well kept up. It's an area of high unemployment and underemployment, and over the last decade, they've lost 10% of the population due to people basically moving out to find work. It's an area where different technologies exist next to each other, and an area where certainly the internet is making its presence felt. So in the time of the research, in that 1 year, there were 7 cyber cafes for a town of 13,000 inhabitants. It's also a place where, far from flinging the laptop over your back and going to work, people would actually also have stationary computers, some of them 8 years old, but proudly displayed in their living room as a symbol of modernity and also a symbol of, to a degree, status. This is the telecenter then in this area. So the goals for the telecenter were social inclusion and equal opportunity. It provided free access to the internet. There was only a small fee for printing and such things. And it was also the classroom for these IT classes that were offered for free from the state to out-of-school adults. Chile's got a population of 17 million, and the Chilean state sponsored 500,000 free IT courses for 500,000 people who were out of school. So the telecenter infrastructure was key to that effort. Now, in the literature of ICT4D, when we talk about internet access, we sometimes use dimensions such as availability, affordability, and skills that are necessary to access the web. But in the empirical research, it also became very clear that these issues around gendered norms on the use of space and gendered norms on the use of time were absolutely vital to understanding how the telecenter was succeeding or not succeeding. So this was the cyber cafe, commercial cyber cafe. You can see basically the very separated areas in which you could actually access the internet. And you get an idea also with the semi-naked bodies on the wall, what kind of vibe was kind of in this space. It was certainly a place where at a stretch during the day, a woman could go, but certainly not in the evening if she wanted to emerge with her reputation intact.
This is rural
Chile, yes. This, on the other hand, was, if you want, the telecenter space next to the library. Big downside was public opening hours. And, of course, limited privacy. If you look at, he's looking at his screen, there's certainly a visibility as to what you were doing online. But it was a space where it was perfectly acceptable for people of different genders and ages to actually come and go, including actually bringing their kids. So this is the telecenter director also talking to a client and her kid. The same telecenter director then talks about time. In the beginning, it was difficult with the women because the men come home in the evening, and when things at the IT training courses take a bit more time, the men come home and the food's not ready. So we told the women, you go do all the housework first and leave it ready, and then you come here. So interestingly enough, they're not messing about with actually trying to ignite discussions about household division of labor at home and who should be doing this work. What they're effectively suggesting is that, you know, maybe here's a workaround, maybe you can do it first and then you can come. What's becoming clear from this quote and from other empirical material is that whether or not women and men had time to actually use the telecenter services depended a lot on how it was symbolically presented in their households. And for women, it was often seen as a sort of a nice-to-have extra, whereas for guys, it was often a way of getting a livelihood. So let me introduce you to Marta Castillo. So in the book, there's actually a full chapter that is all about meeting people. So I'm introducing the reader to some of the people I was meeting and giving them a bit of a flavor of the lives there and also understanding their situation. So Marta Castillo is a micro-entrepreneur, a single mom, head of a household, three kids, and also looking after her mother. She's on low income, has a basic educational background, but her key trump card is that she spent some time as a cook and a maid with a rich family in Santiago. And that means that she's got very good cooking skills, and she's got the cultural resources to give that cooking fancy names and presenting it nicely and so on. So she's running a jams, pastry, and small catering business. She took the free IT courses at the InfoCenter. She uses the internet at the InfoCenter, for example, to research recipes to diversify her production. So she was actually making the connection that people in Algún were getting older, and therefore there would be an increase of number of type 2 diabetics, and therefore she would have to move on with her jam and pastry production also to recipes that catered for them. And she was using the internet for that. Her hope was to organize a women's group that she'd initiated to actually cater for public orders from the schools and from the hospital and basically provide them with jams or pastries or other foodstuffs. This is her media use. So in the book, I contextualize media use such as for the internet with others such as television, radio, and mobiles. And all of Marta's internet use here was dependent on the telecenter. The same time, as far as the online procurement system was concerned, Marta had never used that system, and the local hospital at the same time was actually starting to source those kind of jars of jam from a big distributor in Santiago. So they were basically buying that in bulk. It came 8 hours on a truck from the national capital, and basically that introduction of the system of the same Agenda Digital worked out negatively for Marta. So if you wanted to map that very briefly onto the choice framework, Marta is someone who's got a lot of social resources through her women's group. And she's also got these social resources with the InfoCenter director. She's got the cultural resources from being the maid and cook in Santiago. And she's got masses of psychological resources, the ability to envisage her, a life, the high degree of resilience that she has, several kinds of aspects there. And because she's a single head of a household, it means that she has control over her own time. So there's a few resources that stand out here which allow her to negotiate that social structure, including the change of technology, the introduction of the internet, but also the policies and programs like the free IT courses and the internet access that she gets. There are aspects, however, that she can't overcome, like, for example, the institution of the new e-procurement system that she basically fails to kind of engage with. So there's a degree of extension of choice for her. She's aware of some of these choices, uses some of them, and achieves these choices. In particular, she achieves easier communication, increased knowledge, and to a lesser extent, also an increased income through this. So again, I'm applying the choice framework to some of these realities that I found in the field. So to conclude, a few messages from the book, and there's a few more, obviously, in the different chapters. The point is to think about development not as growth, but as the freedom of people to live the lives they have reason to value. This is the essence of the capabilities approach. And individuals and communities may have very different values. So we need an approach with radical pluralism at its heart. So instead of getting everyone onto the same bandwagon, we need an approach that allows for these different paths. The choice framework is designed to help us with the operationalization of the capabilities approach, and it's supposed to be used as a living tool. So it's, you know, in the tech language, it's mashable. It's a mashup itself, and it can be remashed and use whatever you find useful. It's important to recognize the multiple resources of income-poor people. So instead of kind of, in some ways, pathologizing poverty or basically treating people as recipients of aid, we need to respect their agency. And this agency is based on this number of resources that they can access. But at the same time, we need to never underestimate the power of structures. And this is the kind of the double act that we have to perform. So we need to give people credit for their agency, but we mustn't underestimate structure. And in practical terms, there might be some mechanisms in which we can support choice in development. So there's things like going for a more open and malleable technology rather than a more closed one, thinking about participatory design of technologies, recognizing that there's more than just economic limits that we need to negotiate, but also to negotiate ecological, social, and in some case moral limits of what we want from technology. We might think about expressions of choice such as voucher schemes, or in the case of Brazil in particular, I now work a lot in Brazil, there's expressions of choice such as participatory budgeting, which allow for people to express their preferences on how public funds are being used. So there's already a lot of ways in which we can apply principles of choice in this kind of public process of development. So thinking development beyond the growth paradigm and planning and designing for choice are, if you want, my kind of two key messages to take away. And the rest is in the book. Book is available, but I'd also be very interested in your comments and your feedback in this round, and I'm delighted to hear Nancy's comments as a discussant. Thank you very much.
Shall I use this? Does this work?
It's not for a room like this, for a recording.
So
it's just for recording purposes.
Okay. That's a hard act to follow, I must say. That was very impressive. I think what I can do is just underline some of the importance and the uniqueness of the contribution that Dorothea has made. But I also like very much Colin's comment about the really interesting nature of this book. I find that my indicator of it is, can you read it lying down? And the answer is yes. It's the kind of book that you can lie down on the sofa to read, and it'll keep you going several hours. It's very attractive, very attracting reading. So I enjoyed it very, very much. Your use of SEND's development of freedom approach as a building block for the really difficult area of trying to assess the impact of ICTs for development, which is so much of the core of what the whole ICT for development field is about, is very impressive. And it is so refreshing to see the move away from the purely economic, because so many of the studies that we see lately do it entirely in terms of what percentage of take up in the penetration of the internet will directly correspond to percentage increase in GDP. And the same thing with mobile phones, and the same thing with women and their uptake of this technology and their technology. And the test for its introduction is supposed to be, well, if you can't connect it to an increase in GDP, why would you do it? And you've given us a whole list of answers of why you might do it. And they are as validly development as the purely economic. It is important that she points out that this isn't the first time that, that people have tried to operationalize, not really to operationalize, but to turn SEN's capabilities approach into measurement. He had a lot of influence on UNDP with the Human Development Index. And he resisted it at first, but then he went to work with it as well. And it was a way to look at not just the economic, but to also look at health, education, and also individual income levels. And a number of scholars have connected SEN's approach with ICT4D, but they have not done what you have done, which is to try to operationalize it, and operationalize it through this diagrammatically expressed choice framework. And what is also very unique about what you have done is you have really succeeded in translating that into a very people-centered approach, looking at how it impacts disadvantaged people in Chile. Two of the important dictums that you set out in your exposition today and in the book is that the social embedding of the technology is socially embedded, and that much of technology has gender aspects to it. And all of us say these things. And if you go through the book, you find dozens of examples of it from real life that are really the proof of the pudding. So I think that that was extremely well done. The impressiveness of your research approach, long-term field work, 3 rounds of 5-month participant observations, 100 in-depth interviews combined with a theoretical basis and a very strong grounding in the local context in order to understand the underlying principles and recurrent practices. I would say that your examination of the gender issue in a book which is not called The Gender Issue is unique. It's very good. It's extremely well documented. And I like particularly your critique of what seems like great awareness on the part of Chile in recognizing gender in its ICT policies. And this is how far the counting people have got to measuring gender awareness. And it's purely accounting that is gender mentioned in the ICT policy? Check. If mentioned. And what you do is give the lie to the fact of apparent gender awareness in an ICT policy not translating to gender awareness on the level of when women have to deliver 3 hot meals a day, it's going to be awful hard for them to get away and go use an info center. you make the case for people-centered ICT policies so well in your examination of Chile Compra, the e-procurement system. What Chile Compra failed to do was take into account anything like decentralization, anything like degrees of economic development, economic, social, political development in different parts of the country, about the need to support local entrepreneurship, to encourage the development of micro-entrepreneurs, particularly among women. And it was this very interesting juxtaposition of Chile's ICT policy, which really was terribly egalitarian with the info centers, with the digital literacy courses, with the outreach. They were absolutely doing it right in terms of moving towards social equality. And then you have this Chile Compra, which wipes out people's dreams by the fact that it looked at really economic efficiency as the decision point for what would be chosen as the supplier. And in effect, it had a negative impact on the objectives that the ICT policy was hoping to foster. Your collection of people stories are absolutely great. I'm glad that you sampled them for us here, but that is one of the most fascinating parts about the book. And it underlines how people had different ideas about the lives that they had reason to value, but ICTs helped towards the variety of them. Some possible avenues for further research. I wish that I could be the Mahbubal Haq talking to you, the protege of Sen, and saying, maybe we could take this to a quantitative analysis, because it's when you get some numbers that you can really make an impact on policymakers. And, you know, there's a good deal of work which is being done, which takes basically qualitative measures that you have and turns it into possibly some quantitative results that would look not just at outcomes, but at root causes, and that would look at social context. Context and inputs, and that might be interesting to look at. Sen was worried about this. You know, he said, how could you capture the full complexity of this with a number? And he resisted it at first with the UNDP Human Development Index, but the Human Development Index is something that policymakers pay attention to. Yep. So possibly to be able to translate that aspect to measuring information technology for development. I must say, just on a personal note, I'm doing some work now on the Partnership for Measuring Information Technology for Development, and it's basically a UN and associated partnership. And I was supposed to come up with suggestions about new indicators on gender. And I tried to talk about non-economic indicators, and that got scratched out at stage one. but that was only the first try. So perhaps if someone with the strength of your work and the grounding could try it, it might work. It would be great for you to go back to Chile. And now that it's been maybe 7 years since the major work would be done, And I'm going to do, this is a spoiler alert right here. I figured out the name of the city.
Okay.
So I can't say, but I know where you would need to fly to go back there, and perhaps you will. So thank you very much for a fantastic book.
Thank you. I'll come back very briefly, but I'm very keen to hear questions. So just on those points. So just to say, Algun, they were the first to basically be given the overview of the findings. So I think yes, definitely. I'm kind of going back, and it's I think it's an ongoing relationship. But I think it's also really important to work with the people that have been involved in your research early on, and sort of returning the information and returning the findings to them before you go and pitch it to a fancy publisher at MIT Press. Then quants, I think it's a mega challenge. I'm delighted that in the Human Development Association, Human Development and Capabilities Association, there's over 200 scholars working on the capabilities approach. And in situations like this, I like to always kind of deflect and say, yeah, I'm sure there's some really apt scholars also working on that. So I'm glad that there's a whole bunch of people doing that. So the HDCA, for anyone who's interested. And Chile Compra, recently they've actually introduced also ecological criteria as part of their logic of ordering public services. But they haven't gone as far as introducing social criteria yet. We have a project called sustainablechoices.info, which actually tries to work with them in a constructive way with the Chileans and the Brazilians on introducing more social and environmental criteria. And the Brazilians are far more advanced on the social criteria side. And so maybe there can be some South-South learning there. So.
You, your presentation did a really good job of outlining the local influences as far as gender for access to the internet. And one of the assumptions that I try to fight when I'm reviewing this work is is the internet is this automatic infinite resource. And I was wondering if your interviews with the people, you mentioned that the people you're dealing with, you need to learn English in order to use the internet correctly. Did your work, just through your interviews, indicate any gender or other accessibility concerns for the people once they finally got onto the internet and trying to find the information or the other resources that they were seeking?
Well, so the interviews were obviously all in Spanish, and there is a significant amount of also information online in Spanish. That's less the issue. The question is if there is local relevant content. And there's a section in the book that talks a little bit about the representation of this place in online space. And there's an interesting story of local elites capturing the story of the place to present it online. So if you want, algun.cl is controlled by a local intelligentsia. There's an interesting parallel there with you know, what we know about Wikipedia editing and so on. Basically, who's producing this content, and therefore what control do they have over the narratives that are there? On top of this question about was there enough local content, no, there wasn't, certainly not in terms of relevance to people. People had to do a lot of translating. There's an example in there of producers of almond oil, basically relatively income-poor people imagining that they could actually forage for almonds and then somehow harvest this olive oil. They then created the machine out of nothing to try and press out this olive oil out of the almonds. And they were trying to figure out what in the world people were doing with almond oil. And their inspirations came from, you know, Spanish website, but also Portuguese and Italian websites that were talking about almond oil. So you know, there was a lot of creativity, ability to imagine amongst people themselves, and then, you know, using whatever snippets they were and translating that to their local content. But there wasn't a lot of material that actually spoke to them directly.
Like a quick follow on. So part of this might also, I mean, has to do with skill, right? And this gets to this point because, of course, presumably the people who are running algorithm.cl are more technical skill. So, I mean, like treating the internet as something, you know, I mean, the idea is the ability to use it. And I guess that's part of one of your, on your little matrix. So.
Yeah, I mean, skill is, in a sense, is part of the educational resource element, and at the same time, it's the skills thresholds are part of the technology element of the structure, because, you know, different technologies have different skills thresholds and so on. And so one of the questions we might ask is, you know, if we're talking about ICTs, how can we bring down some of these skills thresholds for people so we have a wider network of people participating in content creation, for example.
If I may say, I'm a women studies scholar at the MIT Women Gender Studies. Sure. So listening to the, you know, knowing about the topic of the book, you know, I was very much drawn specifically for the term capability.
Yeah.
And the way you are linking, you know, internet and capability, because my field is English and literature and, you know, gender theory. But I was very impressed to see the way you interpreted capability in terms of you have the reason to value the, that. So that is called capability, that you value what you need to achieve in your life. And I see that the examples that you gave, I apologize, I came late.
Yeah.
I missed some of it. The Maria Castello, her example, and how she sort of achieved what she wanted to achieve, you know, under bad circumstances of her life by, you know, getting information to internet, how to sell her recipe and how to, you know, improve it. But you also suggested about the agency and how that agency of the poor people should be valued rather than being stigmatized or, you know, having that kind of bad or needing foundation. So, in other words, I'm very happy to see this work because I just also finished my manuscript on capability and working on Shen's theory. But seeing this, I know he's an economist, so I brought him to the field of literature, but his connection to the internet was, you know, amazing. And I would love to know a little bit more about what is your take on this agency. Quality,
you know,
how you can respect more the agency of the poor
people. Yeah. Thank you for that and those contributions. And I'd be really also interested in the work that you're preparing to do. So please
share. I think agency and poverty. Now, I have an empirical answer, which is if you go and live in a local community and you see what people are doing with their lives, you cannot fail to be impressed by the resourcefulness of people locally who don't have a lot of financial and material resources. And it's empirically wrong to simply assume that they are therefore, you know, somehow completely curtailed in their agency or that they don't have some of these other resources. But I can also see how politically that's actually a sort of a rather dangerous route to go down, because if you acknowledge that, you know, it's not all about material resources, it's not all about financial resources, then you end up in a position kind of saying, well, look, you know, if you're poor, then maybe you just haven't developed your psychological resources enough. Okay. Maybe you just need to pull yourself together and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and have a bit more perseverance and come on here. And, you know, I find that a dangerous route to go down. I think we need to acknowledge that there are structural conditions in which agency can flourish. So, I mean, I go a little bit sort of squishy and hippie in the final chapter of the book, where I actually say, look, there are certain things like libraries, like public spaces, like parks, where people actually build social resources and cultural resources and psychological resources, and they're collectively funded. And they are good investments. They're not good investments financially, no. You may not be able to show that X amount of micro-entrepreneurs got their inspiration from bookshelf X. But in terms of actually creating a space where people can develop resources that go beyond the material and the financial, they're incredibly valuable. And right now in the country I live in, the UK, they're cutting libraries. You know, our parks are under threat. Our kind of public spaces are being privatized. This is not an environment in where we properly value the significance of structure to allow individuals to flourish, develop their resources in order that for them to actually live the lives they have reason to value, for them to actually extend their choices. And I think that's, in a sense, that's where politically the book is kind of going. Yeah?
But also in many other countries, there is a political climate and also a dominant policy that broadband industry, only with the help of broadband industry, digital inclusion can be achieved because broadband industry deploys infrastructures and things like this, and only they have the money and government doesn't have the money. And I wonder how whether your framework takes this into account, because as far as I have understood your framework, it's you look from the perspective of the government, and it would be a good policy approach to look at to the pluralism, to the local pluralism and the needs and local values, and then think about how can we achieve digital inclusion. But if you have to take into account the big player, the industry, how would this framework work, or does it work?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really, really good question, because in a sense it highlights one of the challenges of this journey that is translating the capabilities approach into something more concrete. The capabilities approach has at its heart a kind of an individualist perspective. And it's one thing where there's a lot of work currently among scholars to consider how there could be a more collective response. And there's, you know, if you had to kind of say, I praise in my book in many ways all the wonderful things that the capabilities approach does. But there's a few weaknesses. And, you know, I've already mentioned the issues of jargon, but there's also issues of how do, you know, not giving us an answer, how do we scale this up? Or, you know, not necessarily giving us an answer how we deal with conflict and how we negotiate conflict. And when we talk about, you know, in a policy example like you've offered, we're talking about players with different interests. We're talking about multi-stakeholder relations. We know that we work, if we talk about information technology, we will have to kind of basically create viable partnerships with the private sector. We will have to negotiate different relationships, and the capabilities approach doesn't necessarily give us particularly good answers to start with for that. So the next step is, how do you translate this? And so one of the things that kind of come up in the framework here are the institutions around, you know, institutions, organizations, and how to combine these and include them. So we need, I think, when we talk about multi-stakeholder partnerships, we need to find ways in which we incorporate dialogue between public and private sector in viable institutions. Nancy could kind of talk a lot from her experience about multi-stakeholder partnerships in our field, and it's been a story of occasional exclusion of the private sector and then occasional takeover through the private sector. But we haven't yet found a way where we can, you know, on a routine basis, develop constructive relationships. And yet there's a massive need, like you highlight. The book doesn't give you masses of answers for this particular issue, but it is definitely an area where we're working on. And my current area of research is this questions around sustainable procurement. I've referred to it in Chile and Brazil. And that's something where you need to work with the companies that are supposed to be offering those sustainably sourced goods and services.
Amazing work, by the way. Thank you for your contribution. I'm working on a project. We've had some amazing brains behind it. And our intention is to bring every person online, regardless of their economic status. So this is amazing work towards that. One of the questions that I'd like to ask you is, in your research, have you found a way to show the government that it's in their best interest to bring everybody online, or an institution?
I think I can best answer this by thinking about the reception of this work. And basically, we have presented this in different kind of policy scenarios as well. And certainly, Nancy mentioned, a kind of traditional narrow view of kind of saying, look, X amount of increase in internet penetration or mobile penetration is going to give you this much more GDP. And there's like a debate around that. And my personal take is probably to deconstruct the question, because I wouldn't go for the GDP argument in the first place. So there are several organizations, whether it's, I could think of UN Women, UNICEF, we're currently doing a project with them, who are very interested in these other arguments for why access to information technology matters. And this in competition, where we're talking about, in some cases, is it, how significant is this, compared to, not creating a new school, but building a new annex to the school? Should they be investing in this or in this? We're not talking in a trade-off free space. But I think there is interest, but it's worth checking out which organizations are particularly interested. So the organizations in the ICT4D space that had a particular strong interest in this work have been UNICEF and UN Women. In other spaces, in ICT4D, ISCD, which is an NGO in the Netherlands, which I would highly recommend, and also Street Invest, the small charity in the UK, who are interested in taking that beyond ICT4D, working with street children. So, just from the organizations that I mentioned, that gives you a sense of where you might get open ears.
First of all, I think it's clear that one has doubts about using economic growth as a term of development. But just as you're quantifying the capabilities approach, you're talking about possibly doing that, can't we qualify the notion of economic growth so that it includes certain important factors like equality, et cetera? And the other problem is I don't quite understand from your description how the poor are intervening in this and how they're inputting what they want their choices to be, what they want their real options for making these choices to be. So I wondered about that, and I wondered if you took a straighter community in the United States, let's say, and you say, well, we've got this block grant. Well, we can fix the libraries. I mean, everybody cares about the libraries. Our libraries now are closed for the rest of the summer, our public libraries, on Sundays, and I think it's just a disgrace, And we could improve the parks, and we could improve the schools and this stuff. Or we can give each family just a lump sum of money. What do you think these straighted communities in the United States will decide?
They'll go straight for the individual.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, unless you want to restrict yourself only to Chile and to developing countries, it does raise a question of how this capabilities approach is going to handle.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to remember in a sense here is that it starts out as an approach, and the way I use it in the book, it starts as kind of seeing this as individually owned resources. But I'm currently in the process in the next newsletter of the HDCA, for example, I'm publishing a piece that kind of translates that into collectively owned resources and so on. And I think we can learn a lot about, you know, when it is most appropriate for individuals to kind of go their own way, to live the kind of lives that they personally value, and then when we actually need each other to create the kind of spaces that we value. So I dare anyone, if they value to have a farmer's market locally, to create that on by themselves. You know, there are some times when you need collective action. And just because, you know, since, say, the 60s and 70s, we've come slightly out of practice with those kinds of collective action approaches, I think what we're seeing right now is a kind of a growth in fashion towards actually creating some of these collective responses to joint visions of what we value. I think that's coming back.
I suggest that the farmer's market is very individualistic as a solution. It only covers, applies to a small number of growers and only a small number of educated and affluent consumers. So the real collectivist approach there would be to get better Food and Drug Administration rulings and that sort of thing. So I'm a little confused with that example.
I'm not going to sort of defend to the kind of end of my life the kind of the farmers market as an example, but I think what it shows us is a move in scale from Doreen Massey is a fellow geographer and a much more famous one than I am. She basically argues about how we need to get away from a Russian doll ethics of geography, where we basically care about those closest to us most, and then maybe the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And, you know, hopefully what the book can also do is to create a degree of empathy with people who are very far away in spatial distance, but whose aspirations in their lives don't seem so very different from people also locally.
Quick observation, then maybe Nancy wants the last word.
Just a question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one, you had a slide about sort of from process to system. Is that
mm-hmm.
Kind of holistic and sort of these approaches, which to me struck me as inherently internet-y, at least in the way that we want to believe the internet functions, right? That moving from this kind of development, here's a recipe, you follow the recipe, then you end up with a thing, and it's a, you know, it's like, Here is the recipe, you do it, and then it's done, which is absolutely not how technology development works, right? Not how the internet works and not how life works. But I think we've learned from internet stuff that that's exactly what doesn't happen, and that there is more holistic. It is a point of interconnection. It is a process and is a system. And so to me, I heard that exactly as development needs to be more internet-y. Now, whether internet actually operates that way, but at least our conception of the internet. Two, I think the structure versus freedom, or structure and freedom observations are really important and uncomfortable in some ways, right? Because you're saying freedom. We want people to choose, and we want to move away from that development recipe that says we need more of this, and then we're going to get that, because we know that that doesn't work. So we want people to be free to make the excellent choices that I would argue ultimately will translate into good outcomes, right? They're going to translate into... Maybe it's way down the road into more economic outputs, into better education outputs, into better community stuff. They're going to, you know, done properly, they're going to have a good outcome. We probably can't track them in real time. So there's some trust there in the system and let innovation happen and let people build things and experiment and understand that they're going to identify opportunities and needs that may not have an economic impact immediately but are going to have some sort of positive social impact. So that's like the freedom, exciting part, right? But we all know that you can't just leave the world to its own devices. Then you end up with some sort of chaos, and perhaps, in all likelihood, not everyone. The rising tide does not lift all boats with equal rapidity. So that's where the structure part comes in and says, well, we need to figure out some way to add some structure in here in a way that is not inconsistent with that freedom part, that it is a platform, but doesn't, you know. So I think that's a profitable area for further exploration. And that both of those to me also, they sort of take me to the measurement question, which is a really hard and, again, uncomfortable one. The natural answer is no. If you measure most things, things that are unqualified successes would not have been measured. So what's the point of measurement? Because we're not going to capture the stuff we want to capture anyway, which I think is to some extent true. On the other hand, you can't say don't measure it, because if you don't measure it, then it didn't happen. No one gets credit for anything, and it's not perceived as legitimate. There's no investment. So it's kind of a political problem that until we take on the measurement thing in a real way, and I'm not saying you should. I'm glad 200 scholars are, and Nancy's going to take care of it. the measurement piece is important. And I think measurement, broadly construed, qualitative and quantitative, and we require some real creativity in how to look at it. And then the final observation is that, just as I sort of argued that development, you're making a case for development being more internet-y, I think ICT here is kind of development-y, which is to say, if you spend much time doing international development, you realize that something on the order of like 50% of all problems could be, this is as a non-scholarly statement, 50% of all problems are gender-rooted, I would argue. Whether it's, you name the issue in development context, there is a huge gender role. And it should be no surprise that even though we want to think that technology is an equalizing force, it is in fact, it repeats those same sort of dynamics. So I think it's really important that you made all these very clear observations about how gender intersects with technology, and how technology does and doesn't change those existing dynamics.
Mm. Yeah.
I just had a very small query, which is you cover many, many aspects of the gendered nature of the intersection with technology. Did you run into any cases of gender-based violence of the sort of women experiencing violence from their partners because of their use of either internet or phones?
It was a very conservative community in rural Chile, and yet I didn't run to any of this. Having said that, it was early days in adoption, so this hadn't been, this hadn't become more commonplace. And it's worth noting that, I mean, just socially, we know that basically Chile was one of the last countries to legalize divorce, for example, in the early 2000s. And so it's in a sense, it's also a society where, at least for a very long time, the idea of a lot of what's behind those suspicions of gender-based violence is marital infidelity, and so marital infidelity came with a very, very high price because of that. So I think Chile is a special case in that particular debate. We're currently doing the work for UNICEF, looking at the use of information technology in child-focused development, and there, one of the aspects we're concerned about is anything to do with technology-related incidences of violence.
So, with that, on that note, let me re-invite you to go outside and grab a book. To grab one of these flyers to hear more about Dorothea's great program at Royal Holloway, and to please join me in thanking Dorothea and Nancy.